Okay, we begin with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Today is July 19th, 2014. Okay, good morning, everybody.
Sorry, you're trying to
What was that? Okay, so today we're taking the Anapanasati Sutta. This is Sutta number 118 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the title Anapanasati means, of course, mindfulness of breathing. Okay, this sutta has a counterpart in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's chapter 54, I think it's sutta number 14, something like that. But this long preliminary passage is quite unique to this sutta. And it seems that the preliminary passage has been inserted here in order to give special emphasis to the importance of mindfulness of breathing. Because it said that Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, that this was the meditation subject that the Buddha used in the preliminary phase on the night of his enlightenment in order to gain the jhanas, the samadhi. And so it becomes a very major meditation subject in the Buddhist tradition. And often it's taught to beginning meditators when somebody just becomes interested in meditation and wants to learn how to meditate. Usually we teach mindfulness of breathing, but actually if you've been practicing this for a while, you know it's actually one of the most more difficult meditation subjects. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha is living at Savatthi in the Eastern Park. This was the building that was established for the Sangha by Visakha, the lay devotee Visakha, who was called Migara's mother. And so it seems to, again, to highlight the importance of the sutta. It said that the Buddha was living there together with many of the most eminent of the elder disciples, the Venerable Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Mahakassapa, Mahakacchana, Mahakotita, Mahakappina, the Venerable Mahachunda, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Revita, the Venerable Ananda, and other very well-known elder disciples. And if you don't know who Sariputta, Moggallana, Kacchana, Kodita, Kappina, Anuruddha, Revita, all of them we have on the Bodhi path, where the big stone statues, all of them are represented along that stone path. Okay, so it says that at this time that the elder monks had been teaching and instructing the younger monks, instructing 10 younger monks, 20, 30, 40, and then those younger monks, after receiving the instruction, achieved successive stages of high distinction. This is a kind of idiom that occurs in the suttas, which is a kind of general term which indicates that the monks who were practicing achieved various stages of spiritual attainment and realization. It could be they're achieving the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, or they could have achieved the formless meditations. They could have achieved different stages of insight knowledge, or achieved any of the fruits of the path. Okay, so now it's saying, to specify the occasion, it says that it's the Upasita day of the 15th on the full moon night of the Pavarana ceremony. The Buddha was sitting out in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Okay, what is this Upasita day of the 15th on the night of the Pavarana ceremony? Now in India, there's a period which is known as it's the monsoon period, 3 months when the rains come down very heavily. So this period becomes a special time of observance for all of the religious, ascetic and spiritual communities in India during the Buddha's time, perhaps right up to the present. Because when it's raining heavily, then it's difficult to travel around. So it becomes the established practice amongst the ascetic communities, for the ascetics, the monks, the sadhus, to spend a 3-month period during the heavy rains in a retreat. This is called the Vasa, or Vasavasa, the 3 months of the rains retreat. Usually this will take place, according to the Buddhist determination, it takes place starting from the day after the full moon day of the month of July up to the full moon day of the month of October. And during those 3 months, the monks are not supposed to travel, but to remain fixed in their regular residence. So if there's some special reason, they're allowed to travel, to go outside, up to 7 days, but they have to be back at their regular residence on the 7th day. Okay, then the rain's residence comes to an end on the full moon day, which will be the 15th, according to the lunar fortnight. In the lunar fortnight, one counts usually one fortnight of 15 days. Most of the time, the other fortnight has 15 days, but in order to make the year balance out, some of them have 14 days. So you get months of 30 days, months of 29 days. Then on the last day of the rains retreat, which is the 15th, the full moon night, all of the monks come together in a ceremony which is called the Pavarana ceremony. In this ceremony, because the monks have been living together in close quarters, they might have done something wrong. And so each monk going down in order of seniority invites or requests the other monks to point out to him any faults that he might have committed that he didn't perceive on his own. Then usually when that Pavarana ceremony is finished, then the monks are free to begin traveling again. Okay, so this is the 15th day of that lunar fortnight. It's the last day of the rains retreat. So normally this would be the time when the monks are coming together all for the last occasion before they scatter and go wandering in the four directions. And so the Buddha is sitting there and he's silently looking over the community of monks. And then he addresses them and he says that first he says, I'm content with this progress. But then he encourages them to strive still more vigorously. He says, arouse still more energy to attain the unattained, to achieve the unachieved, to realize the unrealized. In other words, he wants them all to progress further and to make the effort to achieve the final goal, even on that final night of the rains retreat. But then he says that, he says, I shall wait here at Savati for the Komudi full moon of the fourth month. That is, normally after the third month, the Buddha himself would set out wandering. But he wants to give an opportunity, it seems this is his reason, for the monks to stay put, not to go wandering, and to give the opportunity for monks from the outside who have been spending the rains retreat in other places to come to Savati in order to see the Buddha during this last month before the Buddha starts wandering. So the month, this is actually the fourth month of the rainy season, but it's a month when the rains have actually stopped falling. And so it's a very beautiful month in northern India, when the weather is cool and pleasant. Most of the time during the day, the skies are clear, and it's the time when the water lilies blossom. The water lily is called Komudu. So this is called the Komudi, month of Komudi. And then the end of that month is the full moon day, when, well, it's called the Komudi full moon. That's the full moon when the water lilies are blooming and they're illuminated by the light of the full moon. And the weather is clear and cool. At night, one can see all of the stars in the sky. Okay, so now scattered over the countryside, the monks who have been living elsewhere have heard that the Buddha is going to be continuing on in Savati for another month. And so they all leave, or at least many of them leave their residences, and they come to Savati in order to see the Buddha. And during this month, it said, as the weeks go by, the elder monks are teaching even more intensively. They're teaching and instructing the younger monks. And then the younger monks are continuing to strive diligently, and they're reaching still higher stages of attainment. Okay, then when the full moon in the month of Komudi arrives, again the Buddha is sitting out in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of the monks, and he surveys the silent Sangha of monks, and he then addresses them, and he speaks praise of this community. He says, this assembly is free from prattle, free from chatter. It consists purely of heartwood. Heartwood is the hard and solid wood at the center of a tree. It's the wood that one can use to make furniture. And so he continues to praise this assembly. He says, this assembly is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of Anjali's reverential salutation, an incomparable field of merit for the world. Then this assembly is such that even a small gift to it becomes great, but as it generates great merit, and a great gift generates still greater merit. This is an assembly that's rare for the world to see, and it's worth traveling many leagues, even with a travel bag, to see such a community of monks as this. And then he starts specifying the achievements of the monks in this assembly. So he says first that there are starting from the higher and then working down in stages, that in this community of monks, there are monks who have destroyed the asavas, all the defilements, and who have become liberated by final knowledge. That is, that there are arahants in this assembly. There are other monks who have destroyed the five lower fetters and who have become non-returners, who will take rebirth in the higher realms and reach final liberation there. Again, in this assembly, there are monks who have destroyed the three fetters and who have weakened greed, hatred, and delusion. So these are the once returners who come back one more time and then reach the end of suffering. And then there are monks who have destroyed the three fetters and who have become stream enterers, who have at most seven more existences before reaching full enlightenment and gaining liberation. Then in the next couple of paragraphs, he speaks about the practices of the monks in that assembly. And first he goes through what are called the 37 aids to enlightenment, which are arranged into the seven groups, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts or right kinds of striving, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, the Noble Eightfold Path. Then he comes to the specific meditation subjects that the monks are practicing. And he says that in this assembly or in this community, there are monks who are practicing. We have the four immeasurables, that is the boundless loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, equanimity. Then there are monks who are practicing the meditation on foulness or the unattractive nature of the body. This is the meditation on the 32 parts of the body in order to see the unattractive nature of the body. Then there are monks who are practicing the contemplation of impermanence, observing the rise and fall of the five aggregates. And then he says, in this Sangha of bhikkhus, there are monks who are devoted to the development of mindfulness of breathing. So in a way, he's sort of gone through the whole register of items till he comes to the item or the subject that he wants to focus upon in this discourse. Okay, so now in section number 15, he actually takes up mindfulness of breathing. And so he says, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. And when the seven factors of enlightenment are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance or liberation. So here we could see that the Buddha is taking mindfulness of breathing, and then first of all, he's, in a general way, he's declaring that it's of great fruit and benefit. But then he sketches the benefits. First, this is like a synoptical teaching or a condensed teaching. So he presents the condensed teaching in several steps. So we have the one meditation subject, mindfulness of breathing, fulfills all four of the foundations of mindfulness. So that is the second step from mindfulness of breathing itself. Then the second, fulfilling the four foundations of mindfulness. Then when the four foundations of mindfulness are fulfilled by the practice of mindfulness of breathing, the third step is that they fulfill the seven bhojangas, the seven factors of enlightenment. Then when the seven factors of enlightenment are developed to fulfillment, then comes the fourth step. They fulfill true knowledge and deliverance, liberation. And so this paragraph sets up a kind of, almost like a table of contents or an outline for the rest of the sutta. And then in what follows, the Buddha is going to fill in that outline by elaborating on each of these expressions. Okay, so first the Buddha is going to explain how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. And first he mentions what would be the ideal places for practicing mindfulness of breathing. That is, one can go to the forest. Here we have forest right around here. And normally if one goes to the forest, the ideal place within the forest to sit down will be at the foot of a tree. Because if one is sitting at the foot of a tree, then one has, often it's easy to form a seat from the leaves that have fallen, the leaves or the pine needles, if it's a pine tree, and then one has the canopy of leaves to give one shelter from the heat of the sun. And if one is going to be sitting outdoors, there's a challenge that one will usually meet. I guess one will meet it here as well as in India, and that is mosquitoes and gadflies and other creatures that come. So what's used in some of the Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, they have, maybe you've seen pictures, the monks carry this big umbrella. In the Thailand they call it a krot. And the big umbrella has a mosquito net tied up over the top of it. So then when one sits down and one takes one's meditation seat, first of all, the umbrella, one hangs the umbrella from a low branch of the tree, and then one unfolds the mosquito net, puts the mosquito net around one. So one could be sitting enclosed in the mosquito net, then the mosquitoes don't have a chance to attack one. But if one wants to be really, one has really strong will, strong determination, one can just make the determination to face the mosquitoes. And initially, you know, it's quite disturbing when the mosquitoes come. But if one just persists, first of all, it forces you to keep your attention on the breath. Because if you let the attention wander from the breath, then you start feeling the mosquito bites, and then you get annoyed with the mosquitoes and start swishing them away, or if one loses the temper, and one squats the mosquito and kills it, then you start worried that you break a precept. And then what you find, at least I found on occasion, not all the time, is that if you just endure the first few mosquito bites, after some time when more mosquitoes come, it doesn't really bother one very much. Because usually it's just It's just usually the first few mosquito bites that are really annoying and irritating. It's a little bit like when you're going swimming, you feel the water, oh, the water's so cold, I don't want to jump in. Feel it again, oh, it's so cold. But then you get up the nerve and you jump in the water. No, it's cold, but you get used to it, and so you can go swimming in the cold water. You know, once you're in the water and swimming, you don't think, oh, it's so cold, because you're used to it. Okay, but fortunately the Buddha says that in addition to the forest, the foot of the tree, then he says, an empty hut. So this would be what they call a kuti. In Asia, it's like a small, like a hut, usually with just one or two rooms. And it's very simple, just a bed, maybe a table, a chair, and then a place for sitting and meditation. And often they'll have either outside or enclosed inside a walkway. So when one wants to break the sitting meditation and do the walking meditation, one has a convenient place of 20, 25 meters to walk back and forth. Okay, well, so one goes to the either the forest, the foot of a tree, or the empty hut. One sits down, one folds the legs crosswise. It doesn't have to be full lotus, but any comfortable cross-legged position. Keeps the body erect, establishes mindfulness in front of one, and then ever mindful, one breathes in, mindful, one breathes out. In a sense, this is like the whole essence of the practice of mindfulness of breathing is really summed up in that one phrase, ever mindful or just mindful, satova asasati, satto pasasati. Ever mindful, one breathes in, mindful, one breathes out. There's a question that often comes up for people practicing or interested in practicing mindfulness of breathing. The question is, where does one focus the attention when practicing mindfulness of breathing? Now the commentaries, you see, the Pali has an expression, parimukkang satting upatthapeva. Parimukkang means literally around the face. And so the commentaries, even going back to the Abhidhamma, say that one puts the attention at the nostrils or the upper lip. But what I found with many people, many other people find this too, that this is a very, very subtle place to keep the attention. Whereas other places are easier to observe at least the effect of the breath coming in and going out. So the advice that I give to people is initially when you sit down, cross the legs, first get a sense, what I call a totalistic sense of the body. That is, get a sense of the body as a whole. And just maintain that awareness of the body in its totality. Maintain it for a couple of minutes. Then become aware that one is breathing in and out. And wherever you can observe the impact of the breath most clearly, let that be one's initial observation post for doing the mindfulness of breathing. So some people will notice the breathing, the effect of the breathing with the expansion and contraction of the chest. So when breathing in, as the chest is expanding, one feels the expansion, and just be mindful breathing in. As one is breathing out, the chest depresses or contracts. So then just be aware of that contraction and make the note breathing out. Similarly, it could be with the rising and falling of the abdomen. Again, when breathing in, just be aware of breathing in with the impact on the abdomen. When breathing out, be aware of breathing out through its impact on the abdomen. I've even noticed, because sometimes, because I have this head pain condition, so I have attention fixing, I have trouble fixing the attention anywhere on the upper part of the body. So what I've noticed is that if I put my attention on the buttocks, I can notice the impact of the breathing in and breathing out on the pressure of the buttocks against the seat. So in breathing in, because the body is expanding, the buttocks press against the seat. Whereas when breathing out, because the body is contracting, there comes a loosening or reduction of that pressure. And so one could feel in, pressing down, out, relaxing that pressure. So for a daily practice, or for initial practice of mindfulness of breathing, I say wherever one can notice the impact of the breath most clearly, just make that the observation post. But for the actual intensive practice of mindfulness of breathing, really with the objective of gaining a stronger samadhi, especially for gaining, if possible, the jhanas, the superior focus point will be around the nostrils or the upper lip, precisely because that's a very subtle area and one gets the direct impact of the breath coming in and out there. And that's where the nimitta will develop. That is the sort of sign, often taking the form of a circle of light. Because when one is focusing on that area, because it's a subtle object, the mind becomes increasingly more subtle. But again, I say it's a very difficult area to focus on. If some of you have practiced in the Goenka's method of the 10-day retreats or longer, he always insists on observing the breath around the nostrils or the upper lip. And I did this course with Goenka it was in the very beginning of 2001 in India at Goenka's own meditation center. And he insisted on observing the breath around the nostrils. And the first day I was trying to do that, and it's very difficult for me because of this condition that I have. So I was just trying to focus on that area, just one session and after another was going by, I couldn't get the breath. And I was thinking, just came to India a few days earlier, and I was thinking, intending to stay for a month, and I was thinking the images were coming, giving up, going back to the travel agent, or trying to book a ticket back to Sri Lanka where I was living the next day. Then I was thinking, they're giving this course even to hardened prisoners who are coming out of it and saying, wow, this is wonderful. And here I am, a monk for 20, at that time, more than 20 years, I can't follow the breath. And I was getting really dejected. Just keep on trying, it's just not working. Then I just thought to myself, okay, I give up. I just sort of drop back, leaning against the wall. The image of going to the travel agent, getting the ticket, flying back to Sri Lanka, leaning against the wall. Of course, I'm breathing in and out, and suddenly, there it is!
found a jewel.
What?
You found a jewel.
Found
a jewel.
Jewel.
Found a point.
Yeah, that's when I relaxed the effort. Suddenly it came by itself. Okay, so whatever the point of focus, the objective is to be mindful when breathing in, to be mindful when breathing out. And so initially, when we'll just, in the first stage, simply be mindful when breathing in, to be aware of breathing in, when breathing out, simply to be aware of breathing out. Whatever else arises, thoughts, feelings, sensations, imaginings, one just lets them all go and again brings the mind back to the breath. I know Goenka doesn't encourage making the mental notes, but he says just be aware of the sensation of the breath. But I would say my own experience is that it's more helpful to make the mental note of when breathing in, making the mental note of in, when breathing out, making the mental note of out. Once the sensation of the breath becomes very clear and distinct, then one can drop a mental label. But to help to avoid the mental wandering and distracting thoughts, it's useful to have that mental noting as a kind of focusing device. Okay, so the basic practice, and really this is like the foundation for the whole building or construction of mindfulness of breathing, is all contained within that first sentence. Ever mindful when breathes in, mindful when breathes out. Okay, but now the Buddha is going to show how the mindfulness of breathing is developed. And here he goes into what is sometimes called the first tetrad, that is a set of four items. So he says, breathing in long, one understands I breathe in long, or breathing out long, one understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands I breathe in short, or breathing out short, he understands I breathe out short. So now, as one is observing the breath with mindfulness, one notices that there's different lengths to the breath. Sometimes the breath is very slow and long. Sometimes it's quicker, more rapid, and so it's short. So in this phase, one makes the mental note of the length of the breath, whether it's long or short. And of course, this is relative, or the two are relative to each other. Different people will have different lengths of their breath. And it's always been a little bit curious to myself why the long breath is put before the short breath. Of course, in just about everybody's experience, when one first sits down and starts to meditate, the breathing comes more, because the mind is still in a core state, the breathing comes more quickly, and so the breath is, correspondingly, the breath is shorter. Then as the mind becomes more quiet and peaceful, then the breath will become longer, more drawn out, and more subtle, till the point is reached sometimes where it seems one isn't breathing at all, but it's actually taking place, but very, very subtly. Okay, and the verb that's used here, this is interesting, that it uses the verb here, pajanati, which is related to the noun panya, which normally means wisdom. So this is not, at this point, pajanati isn't suggesting that this is an act of wisdom, but it's, you could say, it's a clear discernment of the length of the breath, whether it's long or short. Okay, so the distinction between the long and short breaths, these make up the first two items in the first tetrad. Then comes the third item in the tetrad. And with this, there are different interpretations. Okay, it says, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, I'm going to delete here the phrase that comes in brackets. So the actual Pali text says, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. And in Pali, oh, that's right, yeah, from downstairs we had it. Yeah, the Pali expression here is sapa kaya pati sangvedi. So literally, sapa is all, kaya is body, and pati sangvedi means experiencing. Now, this is the way the tradition explains this phrase. This is a tradition that comes down in the Visuddhimagga, the commentaries. They say that what's meant by experiencing the whole body is experiencing the whole body of breath, which means experiencing each breath in its totality. That's why the phrase of breath was added here, following the tradition. So the way they explain this is that they say each breath has three phases. There is the beginning phase, which is, for example, with the in-breath, that very moment when one starts to draw the breath in. Then there is the middle phase, which is the entire extension of the breath, drawing the breath in all the ways up, up, up. Then the third phase is the ending of the breath, just as one brings the breath to an end. Then similarly with the out-breath, there is the beginning of the out-breath, where one just starts to exhale the air. Then there's the middle phase, which is the full extension of the out-breath. Then there's the end phase, where the out-breath comes to an end. So they say that in this stage of practice, one makes the determination to follow each in-breath and each out-breath through each of its three stages. I seem to be getting an echo. Is that the case? I don't know where it's coming from.
You have to adjust where the microphone is.
Is it coming from the computer? Okay, let us
try this one. Maybe run out of battery. Excuse me. Maybe run out of battery. I don't know.
Yeah. This one is strong. There's no problem with the battery. It's just, I hear a bounce back. You do hear it also. Testing, 1, 2, 3. There's no bounce back with this. Testing, 1, 2, 3. No bounce back. Okay, so this is the way the tradition explains it. With each in-breath, one is aware of all three phases, beginning, middle, end. And then with each out-breath, one is aware of beginning, middle, end. And at the time I was working with this, I have to say, I actually wanted to leave it without the bracketed phrase. But my teacher of the time, who was sort of supervising me in this translation, giving advice, he said, people won't understand this. And so he was, in a way, more followed the commentarial tradition more strictly than I did. So he said, to make it clear for people, you should put in-breath and out-breath in brackets. And I said, I don't want to do that because it's not in the text itself. He said, you'd better do it. So I didn't have a choice. But then when I did the translation of the Sanghayutta Nikaya, yeah, by that time he had passed away, so I was free to follow my own inclination. Okay, now if one just takes the words on themselves, by themselves, without following the commentary, it seems to be saying that as one is breathing in and out, one is aware of or experiencing the whole body. And I think what gives further strength to that interpretation is the word patisamvedi. Because the word patisamvedi conveys a stronger meaning than the sense of being aware of. If the objective is to be aware of the entire breath, I think the text would have used the word pajanati. He understands or he knows that, or he knows the entire body of breath. He knows the entire body of the out-breath. But patisamvedi is used for, you know, a direct sort of maybe hardcore experience, bodily experience. And so what seems to me to be the case is that as one is breathing in and out, it doesn't mean that one shifts the attention away from the breath to the body as a whole, but one is still being aware, keeping the focus point on the in and out breath, wherever one can observe it most clearly, but the awareness of the whole body becomes more distinct, so that one is able to focus on the breath area, but at the same time, one gets the sense of the body as a totality in the act of breathing. There's a technical word for this in maybe neurology or physiology, proprioceptive sense. Has anybody heard, come across that word before? Let's see if I can spell it to her. So that is the sense that we have of our body as an entity, you know, existing in space. So we have this to some degree all of the time. You know, even though I'm standing here right now speaking, so I'm not just aware of speaking, but I have this kind of background experience or awareness of my body as a physical entity standing here. And so as one is attending to the in and out breath, then the way I see it is that the sense of the body in its totality sort of emerges and becomes more clearer and more distinct. Okay, then we come to the fourth phase of the first tetrad. This is, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Now what's called the bodily formation here is kaya sankhara. The expression kaya sankhara is used in several senses in the suttas. Usually it's used to mean activities performed with the body, that is, volitional activities done with the body that create karma. But here it's used in a special sense to mean the in and out breathing. We find this definition of the bodily formation in Sutta number 44. And there yeah, this is on page 399. It said here that in and out breathing are the bodily formation. Then the question is raised, why are in breathing and out breathing the bodily formation? Then the reason is given that in breathing and out breathing are bodily. They are states or dhammas bound up with the body. That's why in-breathing and out-breathing are the bodily formation. So that would be the meaning of bodily formation, which is relevant here. It's the in-breathing and out-breathing. And so one trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. One trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And it's said by most teachers that one doesn't make a deliberate effort to tranquilize the breath, but just as one goes on being mindful of the breath, focusing upon the in and out breath, it's just part of the natural process that increased awareness of the breath, or as one is increasingly aware of the breath, the mind becomes more subtle, more refined. And as the mind becomes more subtle and more refined, then the breathing becomes more subtle, more refined, or more tranquil. And something further to be noticed about the last two stages in this first tetrad and all of the other stages that come after this. In the first two stages, the Buddha speaks about the monk, he understands this, he understands that. But from the third stage on, he says, he trains thus. So in this case, it's not just something that one is aware of, but one has to make a deliberate effort to train oneself in these further stages. But most teachers that I've learned from or read or heard say, don't make a deliberate effort to breathe more slowly or more calmly, but just be aware of the breath. And as one is aware of the breath, that is the training. As one is aware of the breath, then the breath on its own will become subtler, more tranquil. Okay, maybe at this point I'll pause and ask whether there's any questions on anything we've covered so far. Not yet going into the later sections. Yes?
So is the training on awareness just...
Please take the other microphone.
So is the training to be aware? That's the training?
Yeah. The training is really to be mindful of the breath. Okay, Victor, and then we'll go.
Yes, when you were discussing focusing between the nostril and the upper lip, is the point to keep the mind there, not follow the breath going all the way in?
Yeah, not to follow the breath going in.
You kind of want to keep it there,
yeah,
in that area.
One keeps the breath in that area.
And if you choose another area, same thing, you want to keep it. If you choose to focus on the, I don't know, your chest or your
pelvis. Yeah, whatever area one chooses, then one keeps the attention on that area.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
And it's not between the nostrils and the upper lip, but it's any place within this area where one feels the breath most distinctly. So it can be, for some people, they'll get the sense of the breath just inside the nostrils. Some people will get it a little bit just on the outer rims of the nostrils. Some people will get it over the area just below the nostrils. So it will differ from one person to another. Well, one starts off not narrowing the area too much. Because if one narrows it too much, then it will become too subtle and then the mind will drift away.
You mentioned, or you talked about why he started with the long breath as opposed to the short breath.
Yeah.
And I assume you speculated about that, and I'd be grateful to hear if you can share some of that speculation.
I don't quite get.
You raised the question of why long came before short.
Yeah.
I assume you thought about that a certain amount, and I wonder if you had come up with any thoughts.
I haven't. I said it's been a puzzle for me. I don't know if anybody else has any ideas about this.
But the only one I thought of, and I rejected, but it came up, is that in his most recent experience, the long breath is what was present for him because he's so deeply engaged in it. But he's teaching other people, and I'm sure he would also have considered that. And so I share your puzzlement.
Yeah.
That's a demon's understanding. I believe when you're running or some activity, your body needs more oxygen, and your breath will be faster. I would believe. While if you're relaxed and you're not doing much, these are layman's understanding of the breath. There are times I could barely breathe earlier, you know. So, and of course, that's why you can't walk or you can't run.
Right, but if you're running,
automatically it becomes faster. I would think. Because the body needs more oxygen. Okay, he's just not another number. He's just like this. But you can also modify it on your own. If you want.
Yeah, but that would mean that the short breath should come first. Okay, one is running, then one stops running. Okay, when one stops, the breath is coming more quickly, so it's shorter. Then as one settles down, the breath is more relaxed, and then it comes longer.
So but you need activity. When there's activity and it needs oxygen, it has to come faster. But at the time of meditation, then you are relaxed completely. And you can vary depending on whether you are the long breath or short. Because then the bodily demand is not there.
But your example seems to imply that the short breath should still come before the long breath. Because when one stops running, one is breathing quickly and shortly. Or maybe the sense is that when the mind is more excited or the body is more agitated, say from running, then one is taking longer breaths because one needs more air. Then as the mind becomes calmer, then we say that the breath is shorter because it's one doesn't have to bring in so much air. Perhaps. Anyway, it's just conjecture. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have my own experience in, I have no problem going into the short breath. I start with the long, from my own experience, I start with the long and I go into my short breath, and I can experience that. My question is, when I go into the body, I don't know, because I seem to go into my short breath and stay there for a while, but sometimes I get lost there, so I don't know where I'm at, if I should experience the whole body, or I'm already doing so. I don't know. See, I've seen this before, and I try to experience it in my meditation, but I cannot differentiate either one because I seem to be in the short breath, and I get lost there, and I stay there, but I don't know where I'm at in the body. It's information. I don't see this one here, how to put it together, and if I'm experiencing it. You know what I mean? Or you don't get it?
I don't quite get it.
Okay, when I'm meditating, I'm in the long breath.
Yeah.
Okay? I go to my short breath. Because always happens, you know, when you sit down, the brain acts for more oxygen.
Yeah.
You're actually excited and thinking, you act for more oxygen. The brain acts for 25% of the oxygen.
Yeah.
As you relax more, your mind is going to reduce the oxygen intake. So, biologically, that's what happens.
Yeah.
So you consume less oxygen.
Yeah.
That's the reason why you're going to go into short breath, biologically, right? But if my question is that as I go into my short breath, I stay there, and that's what I stay. I mean, through my whole meditation, but I cannot see myself to go into the body formation. Where is it at? Because I cannot find, I tried this a few times, and I see where I find this at, in which point, in your experience, I mean.
In tranquilizing the bodily formation.
Tranquilizing, but correct.
It just seems to be the natural process, just as one goes on observing the breath, that the breath will become more tranquil, more relaxed, and it also becomes more drawn out.
So I may be in it already, but I don't realize I am. You know?
Yeah.
I guess I wanted to have a question on paragraph 18, and you were talking about the experiencing the whole body, brackets of breath, and I think all other translations also make that point of breath, but I see your point now, where if we leave that out, it's really we're in a transitional stage where the breath becomes the bridge between mind and body. Because the neck, he then talks about tranquilizing the body. So we're actually moving.
Well, it actually says tranquilizing the bodily formation, and then the bodily formation is identified with the in and out breathing. So it is tranquilizing the in and out breathing, but it could be that the awareness of the whole body becomes, as you put it, the transitional phase into tranquilizing the breath, because the breath seems to have an impact throughout the whole body, and so as one becomes aware of the whole body, then one will realize the need to just to go on breathing more and more in a more and more subtle way. And then as one breathes in a more subtle way, then the in and out breath are becoming tranquilized. Okay.
Thank you, Venerable. I want to thank you for that clarification as the piece about breath and body.
Yep.
I believe that Venerable Tansur Bhikkhu and Thich Nhat Hanh have your own interpretation of breath and body as well. And then, of course, the question that kind of comes up from that, because you have I always find the Anapanasati interesting for this kind of battle that comes out over this particular verse, and so I kind
in
of
a battle between people,
yeah, battle between the interpretation of the breath body, breath in the body, and so I kind of have a practical question: does it really matter aside from trying to be precise with the body?
Yeah. That's a good point.
There's 16 stages in this process.
Could
both work? I guess is kind
of I would say both can work. It's a practical training and. I say people differ, and one interpretation will work better with some people, the other interpretation will work better with other people. And it seems also that as one is already in the first phase, before one gets into the 16 stages, with the first statement, mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out, it seems that to strengthen the mindfulness in that phase, one will be mindful. One has to be mindful of the beginning, middle, end, and then with the out-breath of the beginning, middle, end of the out-breath. So it seems to me that that phase of being aware of the three stages is already taking place in that stage of being ever mindful one breathes in, ever mindful one breathes out.
Thank you.
But I know, just to continue a little bit on this, different teachers have different methods. So like Venerable Thanissaro's, like his lineage comes from a monk who was a student of Achan Mun. He was Achan Li Dhammadaro. So his method of mindfulness of breathing actually involves observing the breath at different points within the body, which is very, very different from the mainstream, the Theravada tradition, which always says to observe the breath at one point. Okay, but now if one is, and I'm sure probably Achan Li Dhammadaro would have been quite an accomplished meditator, but then if one goes with Pa Auk Soyador, the Burmese meditation master, he'll say, keep the mind around the nostrils or the upper lip, because he's very beholden to the commentaries. And so he'll say, this is what the commentary says, that's the authority. Again, take the microphone.
About the tranquilizing the breath, as the breath becomes more subtle, I know from personal experience it becomes harder and harder to keep your mind, it becomes harder to feel the breath because it's become very, very subtle. So is that so what does one do in that situation? Does that lead to the second tetrad? Is that the one?
No, I say one is still in the first tetrad there, but this is what I think it's the Visuddhi Magga suggests this, and I've also found this to be very useful when that happens. Sometimes, like, the breath becomes so subtle that one can't even experience it. But what one does is just put the mindfulness on that area that one has been focusing on. Not trying to observe the breath itself, but just keeps the awareness in that area, just like you are a guard at the entrance to maybe to a movie theater, you know, who has to make sure that everybody coming in has their ticket, or a cat at a mouse hole waiting for the mouse to come out. So one just becomes very observant at that post, just with the awareness there. And as one just observes that, one will catch the breath coming back. But also what's sometimes been suggested, I think it was Goenka who suggests this, if the breath becomes too faint to follow, then one could take a few deliberate long breaths or strong breaths, breathe in and out, you know, deliberately, strongly a few times, so that the sensation of the breath comes back. Then one will pick up the sensation again, and then one goes on observing it as it becomes more subtle. So one could try either of those two approaches.
That's something I was doing. I thought I was doing it wrong. That technique I was using, but I thought I was doing something wrong.
No, it's not wrong.
Okay.
From the internet.
Okay, somebody says, the Buddha began his explanation of Anapanasati without explicitly mentioning mindfulness, alertness, or sampajanya, and ardency. Are these three factors implied in the instructions? Yeah, they have to be involved in following the instructions, even though they're not explicitly mentioned. Because, I mean, he does mention mindfulness. He says, ever mindful when breathes in, mindful when breathes out. And sampajanya has to be there. I translate this as clear comprehension. Because one has to be comprehending when breathing in, when breathing out. And what's meant by ardency is energy. And so there has to be mindfulness, aware, and then clear comprehension and energy. And in fact, if one looks at the Satipatthana Sutta, Sutta number 10, where the Buddha introduces mindfulness of breathing under the heading of mindfulness of the body, then he says that, he begins by saying that there are these four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Then here a monk abides, contemplating the body as a body, ardent, that's atapi, fully aware, this is sampajano, with clear comprehension, and mindful. Okay, so that is sort of the heading or the general instructions for all the four foundations of mindfulness. And then, just below, then we come to mindfulness of breathing. So these factors are involved in all the exercises of all of the exercises that come under mindfulness or contemplation of the body. And so they'll certainly apply to mindfulness of breathing. So even though the Buddha doesn't mention them in the Anapanasati Sutta, but in fact I think he does mention them in fact in the Anapanasati Sutta later when he's relating the 16 stages of mindfulness of breathing to the four foundations of mindfulness. Then he'll bring in, he says that on that occasion the monk abides, this is on page 945, when he's engaged in each of the first four stages, on that occasion the monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware or with clear comprehension, and mindful. So they are definitely present. Robbie, take the microphone.
In the Hindu meditation mantra, they have this what they call pranayama, yep. Deep breaths and shallow breaths. So apparently it may have been there even at the time of the Buddha. In Buddhism, isn't it that we just focus mindfully on the natural breath?
Yeah. The mindfulness of breathing is not, that exercise is actually not really part of the Hindu yoga meditation, but it's part of the yoga practice, which is, you know, regulating the breath. There are certain exercises, but the Buddhist practice of mindfulness of breathing is not the same as pranayama.
Yeah,
pranayama means prana is breath, and yama is, I think, regulating, controlling. But this is just observing the breath at its own natural rhythm.
Thank you, Bhante.
Any other questions? I was intending to do all 16 stages, and now it's 11:20. Okay, I think since it's 11:20, I think we have to stop for the day. And so we'll continue with the rest of the stages. Yeah, we'll have a class next week. So that is, today is the 19th. This will be the 26th, July 26th. And I should mention, I'm supposed to give a library lecture tomorrow. Is it 2 p.m.?
2.
2 o'clock? It's on somewhat controversial topic. I call it riding two vehicles to Nirvana. So if you have time and you're interested, then please feel welcome to come. And then for those who are interested in the study of Abhidharma, we'll be having the second phase of the Abhidharma course over the Labor Day weekend, and extending a couple of days beyond. That's August 29th until September 3rd. So in that program we'll be covering, last year we covered first two chapters of the Manual of Abhidhamma. Now we'll be covering, rather ambitiously, chapters 3, which are concerned with functions, objects of consciousness, chapter 4, on the processes of consciousness, chapter 5 on themes like karma, rebirth, Buddhist cosmology, and chapter 6 on the Buddhist philosophy of material phenomena. So if you didn't go crazy after last year's course.
Yeah.
You mean live streaming? That I think we have to ask, because I'm not in charge of that. Jason or Kylie, we could try to put it on live stream. But it definitely, they'll be recorded and they will go on Ustream. The YouTube.
Will be Ustream, you said?
I said that they'll be recorded and then they'll come up on YouTube.
Okay,
so we end with the sharing of the merits. Now I think you have the page. So we share the merits with the deities, the devatas, the fear spirits, the buddhas, the nagas or dragon spirits, and with all beings, asking them to protect the dharma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mangparam. Metavatacham hei sampadam punyasampadam sabbe deva dantu sabbasampati siddhya. Metavatacham hei sampadam punyasampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, so we'll come back here. Let's be a little relaxed about it. You can come back at 12:30. Then we can have discussion period from 12:30 to 1. Bows to the Buddha.
Out of the bump.